Sharing how to use the center for one-day sittings, and it'll probably take some months or different, you know, over time that we'll actually learn how to best use the building for this purpose. Can you hear me okay, everyone? You can't hear me, but can you go sit really close? I wonder if it also works almost better if you sit right in front of the speaker, because the speaker is on. Everyone else is okay? So I'm really happy to be here for this event. We had kind of a short day sitting yesterday. On Fridays, we do more of a what I call, I think, Dharma practice days, which are not the same as a one-day sitting like we have now, because there's more discussion and more talking. We talk over lunch, for example. And today is a day of silence, silent retreat for all of you. And I will be, today's theme is mindfulness of breathing. And I'll be giving instructions and some guided meditations on the topic of the breath in the course of the day. And we'll be alternating between periods of sitting meditation for probably about 35 minutes with walking meditation for about the same. And then some point in the afternoon, probably the end of the day, but maybe after lunch, I haven't decided yet, we'll have a talk. I'll give a talk, short talk. And when there's these periods of walking meditation, if anybody wants to discuss anything with me, I'm available during that time. You can come and I'll just be up here or somewhere, maybe in the back room or something. And you can... if you have something you want to chat about, just informally, I'm available during those times. We'll stop for lunch for about an hour. It's probably sometime around 12:30 or so, depending how the morning evolves. And I realize for some of you, probably the building's a little bit cold to begin with today. And the heater's on, and probably it'll warm up as we go along here today. No, it's not going to warm up? Okay. So, if you're cold and need another kind of shawl, I have a shawl in my car. I can go out and get it during one of the walking periods for you. And... there are bathrooms. I think probably most of you know there. There's also a bathroom upstairs. So if there's a line for the bathrooms there, you can go up the spiral staircase upstairs to the bathroom upstairs. And also the upstairs room is a place you might want to do, one or two people, maybe one person, I don't know, could do walking meditation up there too. Having enough place for walking meditation is an issue here for our new center. And certainly people can do walking meditation out in the big room out there, along the short distance, but it's not going to hold everyone. I think it'd be fine for people to do walking meditation in here during the walking periods. A few people can do it in here. And maybe what I'll do is, if people want to chat with me, I can be in the little room in the back there, just hang out there if anybody wants to chat. Some of you might have parked in our little parking lot out there. It's a reasonable thing to have done. But I think since we have so little walking space, maybe if you've parked there, you can move your car at the beginning of the walking meditation time, so we can use the whole little parking lot for walking meditation. I believe there's lots of parking spaces on the streets. If you go over to Clinton, for example, one street over, there's often a lot of parking there. And I don't think you have to walk very far. So the day is offered on a donation basis, and there's two baskets in the entryway there, one for what we call operations dana and one for teacher dana. Operations means what it takes for us to now run, take care of having this building of our own, all the various expenses that we have as a center, and the request is that for the operations dana, that you'd make a donation, suggestion donation, of somewhere between $5 and $10 to help us with all those kinds of expenses. And that's the same as we had when we were at St. Mark's. And the teacher's donna is whatever you'd like to do. And how many of you here today are new to meditation or new to this kind of practice? Anyone who's new? A couple of people who are new. So I will, please feel free to come and talk to me at the end of this, little sitting periods. If you have any questions, if something doesn't make sense, because there's a lot of kind of background that for basic meditation practice that probably won't be conveyed today, and so I'll be happy to fill you any of you in. And can you hear out in the back there? Okay. So the theme for today is a mindfulness of breathing, and it's a very important practice in Buddhism. It's a foundational practice in many different schools of Buddhist meditation. And you'd be well served if you only did breath meditation for a long time. In our tradition of Vipassana, we usually expand the instructions very quickly to include other aspects of our life. But generally, the breath is the kind of the central focus. It's kind of, if you imagine our life being a mandala, kind of different experiences, the breath meditation is kind of the anchor or the center, the pivot around which everything else kind of moves from. And but some Buddhist traditions, focus on just breath meditation as the primary practice for years, sometimes for a whole career as a meditator. And in my own practice background, I spent my entire Zen career, Zen practice, which was many, many years, with in meditation, the breath being the primary focus of the meditation practice. There's great power and value to the way in which in Vipassana we expand the instructions to include everything in our experience. Thoughts, feelings, body sensations, sounds, whatever it goes on. But there's also great power in really cultivating well the focus on the breath as a foundation upon which everything else can grow. In part because the breath is really helps with concentration, with focus, stability, with calming and stabilizing the mind. And having a stable, concentrated mind makes it a lot easier than to do the other aspects of Vipassana practice. The mind is agitated and you bring your attention to your feelings and emotions. Some people, that's just the reason to get even more agitated. But if your mind is quite stable and calm, you can kind of look at that and penetrate it in a very direct way. In the tradition of Buddhism, in the suttas, there's a lot of statements about how powerful breath meditation is. Some of the statements that the Buddha made on breath meditation indicate that that it's, you just do this one practice and it'll take you from along the whole path of meditation, right from the beginning right to full awakening and enlightenment. And there's a beautiful story which I gave yesterday, read yesterday, where the Buddha, after he was fully enlightened, went on a 3-month retreat. And you might wonder, well, what does a Buddha have to do going on a 3-month retreat? He's already fully enlightened. He should just be out. I don't know, what do Buddhas do? And so he went off on his 3-month retreat, and he was really kind of solitary retreat because he said, the only people I want to come and see me while I'm off in the woods meditating is a person who's going to bring me the food every day. So at the end of the 3 months, he came out of retreat and he said to his monks, his monastics, he said, anybody from other sects, religious sects of our times, asks what I was doing during my retreat, tell them that I was practicing mindfulness of breathing. And then he went on to say that if a person is not yet enlightened, still kind of in course of practice, the breath meditation is really preeminent practice for leading a person to enlightenment, to helping them become free. And I'm paraphrasing a little bit. And then but if a person is already fully enlightened, then breath meditation is a really preeminent, really wonderful way of living happily and at ease in the here and now. Isn't that nice? So it's a really nice way of living. So for you, you can decide how enlightened you are or not. But either way, it's a good practice. It helps you live happily here and now, which it does. It can be very, very helpful practice in the here and now. And a lot of stress reduction programs rely on breath meditation as a way of helping people, you know, basically be at ease in the here and now. A lot of Vipassana teachers emphasize cultivating the ability to be at ease and happy in the here and now. And but more powerfully, I think for many of us who are not enlightened, breath meditation is one of the ways of helping to not just simply help kind of bring ease in the daily life, but more powerfully to uproot or transform the deep latent tendencies that we have towards fear, towards hate, towards greed, towards anxiety, towards stress that exists deep in our psyche. He said the point of Buddhist practice is not simply to have kind of a stress-free life, but rather to go deeper than that and take out those tendencies we have to causing stress in the first place. If you want a stress-free life, you just go get a massage every hour. And, you know, you can do various things. You can go live in some very calm, quiet place. But that doesn't really work very deeply, because sooner or later you're going to be challenged in that kind of environment. And what the Buddhist path is about is really dealing with those innate tendencies that we have that lead towards stress, and resolving those, not just simply finding a way of organizing our environment so we're stress-free. So the breath meditation does that. And I could read lots of quotes about how the Buddha put breath meditation, mindfulness of breathing, at really the center of his program, and really that it's sufficient in and of itself for leading to following the whole path. So what I'd like to do today is to do various meditations, guided meditations, to help you all become more familiar with your breathing. Some of the meditations are not necessarily Vipassana practices in a traditional sense, but the more familiar you can get with your breathing, the more helpful it's going to be to do Vipassana mindfulness of breathing. And to understand different aspects of it, to understand, become familiar with it in ways that maybe you're not so familiar right now or have been so far. So that it becomes not only a foundation for practice, but it really can become a great refuge in your life. To come back to your breathing, to wake up to your breath, is really, really helpful in many circumstances. I call the breath, mindfulness of breathing, the lubricator of life, because it lubricates life. It makes life a lot easier if you kind of check in with your breath a lot. So that's the idea for today. And do you have any questions about any of that before we start? Is that clear enough? About the logistics, about the day? I think what I'm going to ask, in a little bit, I'm going to ask you to stand in a couple of moments. And what would be nice to do is if we rearrange ourselves a little bit, because what happens in the way the arrangement is here is people tend to sit more and more towards the door because that's where there's space, and then it gets more and more crowded there and difficult for new people to come in. And there is space kind of along there and up here in the corner, and somehow get people to move in a little bit closer so we can have more space in the back. And also, I suspect we don't need as many chairs as are out today. And we could either move some of the chairs back or actually stack some of the chairs maybe. That's even a better way. These chairs can be stacked 10 high. And so maybe we could, you know, take half the chairs which are out here and stack them in the corner there to make more space on the room, on the floor here, for all of us to kind of feel, you know, spacious. So before anything else we do, why don't we all... if someone needs to go to the bathroom, they can quickly go now. But otherwise, kind of rearrange the room a little bit to make it more efficient. Maybe move the chair and move up here. And then we'll proceed. So, we're going to start by standing. And now that you're kind of closer to each other, you might have to be a little bit careful with your neighbor. What I'd like to do is start with a couple of simple exercises that would help us kind of begin awakening up the area of our lungs, our breath area where we breathe, so to help us kind of become more familiar, more alert to it, and make it start that sense of connection to that part of your body. And so first, I'm going to teach you the great mantra of letting go, which is a very important mantra in Buddhism. And you probably have used it at various times in your own life. And the mantra is, oh, you're good at that. So now, you put your hands in front of your chest like this. And then take a really long, slow, deep breath as you lift your arms up on your sides like this. Filling your lungs as you breathe. And then letting go of the breath, lower your arms with a ah. And again. And as you do this, really stretch your arms far out to the sides and up as high as you can go. Fill your lungs, and then one more time. Then lower your hands, and then take a really deep breath now. And fill your abdomen, fill your lower belly with breath. Make it really expand and fill. Fill up your upper chest. And then as you exhale this time, the ah, let your belly fall out, down, expand. Ah. And then sit down. One of the little secrets of the place when it's cold, is cold, I don't know if you are, but it's actually warmer up on the platform. So now, hopefully, if you have a bad back, maybe you want to be careful with doing this. But if you can, lean back and put your hand on the floor behind you. And then lift your chest up. And then take a deep breath into your chest. And then as you exhale with a again, filling the chest, the rib cage. One more time. And then sit up. And then clasp your hands behind your back. And then bring your hands to your left side of your body, pulling your right arm kind of. And then maybe you could also lean back a little bit. So you kind of open up your right rib cage a little bit as you do that. And then take a really deep breath into your right rib cage. Again. And then move your hands to the other side. And the same thing there. Feel your left rib cage. Again. And then put your hands in the usual way you have for sitting. And then gently close your eyes. With your eyes closed, being in your body, sensing it. Once again, take a deep, full breath into your torso as you can. And, and do it again. And then on the letting go, see how thoroughly you can let go of your shoulders, your belly, your back, your arms, whatever tension it might be. And one last time. And then sit quietly, feeling your sensations of your body. And each time you exhale, for the next few exhales, see if you can relax some part of your body, or at least soften it, or send a kind, softening intention to that part of your body. You might start with your face, jaws, eyes, forehead. That inner sense, the inner quiet sense of ah. Let go of your shoulders. Let them soften, your shoulder blades. Each time you exhale. Perhaps you can soften your chest, your rib cage, as you exhale. And particularly helpful it is to soften the belly. And let the belly kind of hang forward, relaxed. In a way that some people have been taught is unbecoming. Let your stomach kind of hang forward. If it tenses up right away, that's okay, then just let it be. But if it's possible to soften the belly, lower center of gravity as your belly drops a little bit. Perhaps as you inhale, there can be a letting go of sorts as the belly expands. And then take a few moments to have a global awareness of your body. Kind of a wide angle lens or wide sense of presence within your body. Perhaps gentle, tender sense of awareness, kind of traveling around your body, taking it in. Being in your body. And then within your body, as part of your body, becoming aware of how the body experiences the breathing. If you were going to investigate and discover, how does the body experiences your breathing? Where do you feel the movement of breathing? And for these next few moments, kind of explore how it is the body experiences the breathing. If you have a normal place, you bring your attention to the breath. At least for these next moments, kind of wander around the body to feel the different places that you experience your breathing. The movement of breathing, the pressure, the letting go, the various sensations. Perhaps you can even feel the contact of your body with your clothes as you breathe. The movement of your body against your clothes. As you feel the body's experience of breathing, staying present for it, aware of it, allow the breathing to to have an effect on your body. It doesn't have to have an effect, but allow for the possibility that the breathing helps calm the body, relax it. Or if you're already kind of sleepy, then allow the breath to energize the body, maybe the inhalations. The breath is a great conditioner. It can bring relaxation when that's needed, or it can bring energy when that's needed. But it requires being present for each breath, the conscious breathing, allowing it to have an effect on the mind, relaxing the mind. The mind will, of course, wander off into thoughts. As soon as you notice that, begin again with your breathing. Discover what it's like to have a conscious breathing, to have awareness with your breathing. There's a world of difference between breathing which happens unconsciously and breathing which happens within the field or the bubble of awareness. Allow the breathing to arise and pass in the field of awareness, taking an interest in what that's like. A sense of possibility, a sense of discovery. Each breath, hanging in there, discovering what happens to you. If you can hang out with the breathing over time, each breath, one after the other. And you notice you're caught up in thoughts and concerns. Come back to the breathing. As you exhale, perhaps relax the thinking mind. Various thoughts and feelings, emotions, experiences might arise for you as you're sitting here. As long as you can keep the center of gravity, the center of your focus being the breath, you don't have to be bothered by those other things. It's okay for them to be there. Just let your intention, your attention be filled as much as possible by the breathing, focused on the breath. For the last 2 or 3 minutes of the sitting, see if you can stay there with each breath. What does it take to be there completely with each in-breath and each out-breath for 2 or 3 minutes? Take 35 minutes for walking meditation until 10:40, and 5 minutes before we'll ring a bell, so you don't have to be looking at your watch all the time. Ring a bell maybe outside on the porch there, and also inside here. Those of you who might be new, if you want to talk about some instructions in either in walking meditation, or if anybody wants a little bit of guidance on meditation posture or anything, the new people or any basic ideas that people want to talk about, I'll go now into the little room on the side there. You can get either through there, or you can get it through behind, through the bookstore, the library there. And we can have a little chat there if you'd like. And as I said, because we have very few little places for walking meditation, I propose that we can also use this room here for walking meditation somehow. I don't think we should move the cushions, but somehow find our way a little bit here and few people can be in here. And those of you who prefer to sit during the walking period, I apologize for you. You'll just have to be with the program. So enjoy your walk. So for the next sitting, I'd like to do a little guided meditation on that I call guided tour of the breath. And again, it's very helpful to become very familiar with what your breathing feels like. And many of us maybe know a little bit our breathing, but our breath actually affects much more of our body than we normally aware of. Many of us know, for example, the rib cages expand and contract, the front rib cages, but the back rib cages also do that, and the spine moves, and all kinds of different parts of the body get involved in the process of breathing. And to start using the breath in a useful way and having a useful breath be useful support for meditation practice, it's very helpful to have a wider sense of what is involved in the body as you breathe. And we'll build on that later as we go on through the day. So as you do this exercise, I'll guide you to pay attention to different parts of your body. And as you bring your attention to that part of the body, see if you can become aware of how the breathing affects that part of the body. Maybe you feel some movement there, and or some pressure, or some warmth, or coolness, or some, a range of things you might experience there. If you feel nothing, that's okay. Just keep your attention there for a little while until we move on. And as you do this exercise, you might also want to, especially if you don't feel anything very much in some particular part of your body, is to breathe a little bit more fully. Usually in mindfulness we say don't make any special effort in breathing. But for this exercise, you can actually breathe a little bit more fully, breathe into that part, or take a little bit deeper breath. Not so much that you get tired or strained, but for the purposes of really feeling what's going on there. And if you take a deeper breath, then you might go back to normal breath, and then you might still then be sensitized to what happens there and then be able to feel it. And so that's the idea. So take a comfortable, alert posture. Gently close your eyes. And then to start off, you can take a few long, slow, deep breaths. And as you exhale, you can relax, let go of your thoughts and concerns. And then let your breathing return to normal. And just hang out for a few moments now, just with your breathing. In your own way, whatever way you feel your breathing. Hang in there with it. And then bring your attention to the middle of your chest. And then become aware of what sensations, what movement occurs as you breathe in the middle of your chest. And you can always breathe a little bit more fully if you'd like to get more sensations. If possible, feeling the sensations from inside the body. And then from the center of your chest, move into the sides of your rib cage, your rib cages in the front, kind of the mid rib cage area on the sides. And feel what happens there. Feel perhaps as you breathe in, the creation of some greater space between the rib cage, the stretching, the expansion, the pressure as you breathe in. And letting go as you breathe out. Moving to the side, kind of side rib cage, all the way next to your arms. Maybe you can notice what happens there as you breathe. Maybe what happens with the sensations against your arms. And then let the investigation now shift to the area of the solar plexus, the diaphragm area. Notice what sensations occur there as you breathe. The area of your diaphragm, feel the sensations near the front and surface of your body, but if possible, also deep inside your body. What happens there? And then down into your belly, maybe the area around your belly button. Notice what happens there as you breathe. If you feel not much, then you might breathe a little more fully into your belly to feel sensations. And then lower down into your abdomen, lower abdomen area. And the sides of your abdomen, the area of your waist. And then deep down into your pelvic cavity, groin area, hip area. Are there sensations that arise and pass connected to your breathing and deep down your pelvic cavity? Perhaps you can breathe more fully and you'd feel more there. What about down into your hip bones, hip joint, your hip bones with a contact with the cushion or the chair? Is there any change of pressure or weight as you breathe in and out? And then move your attention to your lower back, sitting bone area, bottom vertebrae of the spine. And feel what happens there in relationship to your breathing. Maybe breathing a little bit more fully into those areas to feel the alternating sensations of breathing in and out. Moving up the vertebrae, feeling the area of the lower curve of your back, the sides, the muscles, and the sides of the spine. What happens there as you breathe? Moving up to the mid-back area, mid-spine, the bottom of the back rib cage. Feeling the back rib cage area. The movement there, the expansion there. Perhaps you can feel the creation of a little bit more space between the ribs as you breathe in. And moving up further up the back to the shoulder blade area. What happens in your shoulder blades as you breathe? Do they move? Do they slide across the back rib cage? breathing maybe a little bit more fully into that area, to really sense it, to savor what happens there. Staying a little bit longer in the back, the shoulder blade area, feeling what's there, and perhaps as you exhale, let there be a softening there. Sometimes the shoulder blades can sink down the back. And then moving up, further up the spine kind of just above the shoulder blades, going up into the neck. Does anything happen there as you breathe? And then moving the attention to the shoulders, tops, the insides, the sides of the shoulders. And perhaps as you exhale, to let there be a softening of the shoulders. Even if it's just a teeny, teeny bit. And then moving the attention to the area of the collarbones, in the upper chest area, and then again back to the middle of the chest where we began. And then see if it's possible to put all those parts together, to be aware of the whole breath body. Perhaps by beginning, at the very beginning of the inhalation, see if there's some place deep in your body, your stomach, diaphragm area, your chest, where that inhalation first begins. And then as it expands, the wave-like expansion of the breathing expands in all directions, expanding the body, the torso, outwards. The like a wave that moves out in all directions. And then as you exhale, the wave then comes back again, collapses, contracts, back to that point where it all ends and begins. If at the end of the exhalation there's a little pause before you breathe in, if it's possible, relax into that pause and allow the inhalation to arise on its own. If there is no pause, then just relax at the very end of the exhalation, letting go more fully. Feeling the whole breath body as you breathe. If it's helpful, as you exhale, let go of your thoughts and concerns. The end of the exhalation, let there be a stillness, relaxing into the stillness and letting the inhalation begin just by itself, whatever way it wants. We'll build on this as the day goes along, and you'll hopefully begin to get a sense as the day goes along and we talk more about the breath, how the breath is a really amazing ally for your life and very, very helpful. It's connected to so much of our lives that there's a way in which it becomes can be used really as a great support for not only meditation practice but for a normal life also. So this exercise of becoming familiar with the whole breath body is the beginning of that process. So let's take another 35 minutes for walking meditation. So we'll start sitting again at 11:50. And again, if anyone wants to talk with me, I'll be in the little room on the side there. See if it's working now. That's okay. And there's a big emphasis on relying on non-reactive awareness, just being present for things as they actually are, and not to change anything, not to manipulate or do anything about your experience. It's a very powerful practice to do it that way, just to leave things alone and not act on them and just seeing them. In many ways, it's a very advanced Buddhist practice. And in doing, offering this to people just as they come off the street, we're offering people kind of one of the most advanced forms of Buddhist practice available in Southeast Asia and other Buddhist countries in Asia. This practice of non-reactive awareness is often not given to people until they've done a lot of other practice first. One of the consequences has been, though, here in the West, and we often teach this non-reactive, non-manipulative awareness, leaving things alone, letting your breath just be as it is, don't try to breathe in any special way, is that people get the impression that they're not allowed to do anything else in their mindfulness practice. except have this non-reactive awareness. Just pay attention to the way things actually are. And it's actually helpful sometimes to change things, to adjust things, and to make things more helpful as a foundation to allow for that more non-reactive awareness to be present. And one of the things I want to talk about now is it's allowable to adjust your breathing. You don't have to let your breath just be as it is and just be mindful of it. There is a place, especially when people are new to practice, to get to be familiar with the breathing and how their breathing, their own breathing patterns are. And if it's easy enough, to adjust it a little bit, to make it more comfortable, more pleasant. If you want to do mindfulness of breathing and stay present with the breath over time, it helps if your breathing is, if you're interested in your breathing. If you're more interested in what you're going to have for dinner tonight, it's going to be very hard for the attention to want to stay on the breath, because, you know, the dinner menu is, you know, more interesting to go to. And if you can find some way to have the breath be really interesting, then it's be easier to stay with the breath over time. And one of the ways to help make the breath more interesting is to know how interesting the breath is. It's very fascinating, I think. And though for the uninitiated, it could seem really dull. But another way is to try to adjust the breath so it's more comfortable or more pleasant for you. It's not always possible to do that, but some people can actually maybe breathe a little bit more deeply. Or more importantly, there might be ways of relaxing around the breath in various places where you breathe, so the breath becomes more fluid, more full by relaxing more. A lot of our holding patterns, a lot of our reactions and relationship attitude towards life are held in our body and in our way we breathe. If people get really excited or maybe filled with fear, sometimes they hold themselves in a little bit and they hold their breath kind of tight and they don't let some of the feelings flow freely. They get angry. Also, sometimes they hold the anger in and get kind of really tight, shallow breath, as opposed to, because they're afraid of all the energy that might come if they let the anger be the uninhibited way through their body, through their system. There's a lot of different ways in which we hold our chest, our belly, or different parts of our body in relationship to the world around us. And if it's possible to adjust that a little bit so that there's no holding in our inner body, the breath can feel sometimes much more comfortable. If it's more comfortable and more pleasant, then it's more interesting to stay present for the breathing over time. So sometimes that's very straightforward. You can adjust the breathing a little bit and find it more pleasant. Sometimes it's quite hard to find that. It's not so easy to do that, and you have to just be with the breath as it actually is. But with that as an introduction, let's do the next sitting. So make yourselves comfortable but alert. Close your eyes. And take a few moments to take a few long, slow, deep breaths as you exhale, letting go and arriving here. Then let your breathing return to normal. And just for the next, you know, 4 or 5 rounds of breathing, hang in there with the breath. Just stay connected to it. And then become familiar with your breathing, all the different parts of the breath you explored last sitting. And as you inhale, notice if there's any places of resistance in your body to that inhalation. Tightness in the chest, the shoulders, the back, the belly. And as you breathe in, whether it meets some place of holding or resistance, tightness, and if you can discover some places of tightness or holding or resistance, then every time you inhale, let the inhalation be like a massage that gently pushes against it or stretches it. Not forcing it or expecting it to change, but kind of a gentle pushing or stretching. And then as you do that, see if you can yield a little bit more fully to the breath. As the breath pushes and you're in, yield. Let that part of your body let go and relax. If you like, you can breathe again a little bit more fully than usual, either to find a place of tension or tightness, or to kind of massage it a little bit more fully. And as you exhale, let there be a letting go in that part of your body where you might have felt the tension or tightness. Now switch the attention to the exhalation. And is there some place there as you exhale, where you release the breath, that you don't release it entirely? Where you hold back? Where you interrupt the exhalation or hold back from it? Some place of resistance or tightness that doesn't allow you to let go of the exhalation as fully as possible? And if there is such a place, then every time you exhale, let it be like a massage that meets that place of resistance. See if you can let go a little bit more fully each time. One way of helping the exhalations be more full, more complete, is to let gravity help you. Yield to the weight or yield to gravity as you exhale. Let your diaphragm, your torso, your abdomen feel heavy, and let the heaviness let you help you let go more fully. And now, see if there's some way that easy enough, it doesn't cause a strain or excessive effort, to adjust your breathing so it's more pleasant, more comfortable. Perhaps by breathing a little bit more fully, slightly, or letting go more fully as you exhale, or perhaps by feeling more of the breath body as you breathe, or feeling more carefully one spot. Perhaps by noticing those sensations of breathing which have a pleasant quality. Maybe the letting go is pleasant. Maybe the smooth rising pressure expansion for the inhalation is pleasant. There might be unpleasant sensations, but if you can notice what is pleasant, and then connect to those pleasant sensations, letting the breath be more comfortable and maybe more satisfying, there's some way of adjusting it. We can take an hour for lunch, and we'll start again at 1:30. And I thought at 1:30 when we start, we could take maybe 5 or 10 minutes to, if there's any questions about what we've done so far this morning, and about the breath itself, these questions related to this practice we're doing, breath meditation, mindfulness of breathing, and the exercises of this morning. What happened to you, your experiences. We can take the first 5 or 10 minutes for a little question session, and then we'll proceed from there. And please don't have any lunch in here, but you can certainly bring more chairs out into the hallway there if you'd like and sit in chairs. There are also some folding tables underneath the platform there that you could, if you want to sit at a table, maybe Jeff could help. And take the tables outside in the big room out there, and it's more comfortable to sit around a table to eat. And there's a hot water. Is it on? There's hot water for tea if you'd like in the kitchen, cups and teas and stuff. And enjoy your lunch. Oh, this is the important thing to say. I would recommend you eat a light lunch, because if you eat too much food for lunch, chances are when you come back in the afternoon for the next half of the day that you'll be really sleepy and torpid, and you come back much more alert and ready for meditation if you actually eat a light meal. And it's better to eat a light meal for lunch and then save some for like mid-afternoon to snack on if you can't get through until dinner, than it is to eat a big meal at lunchtime. And you know, your normal amount to usually eat for lunch might be fine for daily life where you're more active, but here, if you're coming back to meditate, it might make it more difficult to stay alert. So I'd recommend that you eat a light lunch as seems appropriate for you. And so, certainly enjoy it. Does anyone have any questions from this morning, or comments, or anything they want to discuss about so far using the breath for the subject for meditation? Yes?
Yeah, I was interested in the balance you talked about between the non-reactive awareness and the skillful use of breath.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you had anything more to say about that, or about how one knows when you're
Well, it's easy to see with trying to be skillful about it, because a person can be constantly manipulating and changing and never really, always a little bit agitated because always trying to make some effort. And some people are kind of neurotically always trying to control and fix and take care of things and judge things. And it just gets in the way of. But to only rely on non-reactive awareness too much, maybe you can't, if you do it really well, you can't overdo it. I mean, it's a powerful practice, and if you do it really well. But for some people, they can kind of think they're doing it. And they're kind of a little bit too accepting, in a sense, of just how neurotic their mind is, you know, how they're not so settled, they're not very concentrated. And they're kind of generally kind of accepting the fact their mind is wandering a lot, and that's okay, and I'll come back, and after all, this is non-reactive awareness, so it's okay for me to be caught up in my stories for a while, and I'll just come back and I'll accept that and come back, and you know, after a few years of that, okay. Probably the person realizes it's not so useful, and maybe having some little bit more of a developing a little bit more skill or a little bit more ability to. Maybe adjust or stay, develop more concentration or kind of cut through that would be helpful. I practiced, in my Zen practice, I practiced just being. It's very similar, just being with how things are. And at some point I found I came to a plateau in the practice that was only, I only went further by adding the knowing quality of awareness. I actually clearly were discerning what my experience was. It's very close to mindfulness, but a little bit more investigation. And especially I think for people who are beginners, or relatively new to practice, I think it's useful to kind of develop certain healthy skills as a foundation for practice. So you have a healthy, relaxed breathing as a foundation for a practice. Then it's a lot easier to do non-reactive awareness on top of that. So that's why, you know, I think it's good to kind of spend a day like today kind of focusing on this as a foundation. And then at some point you can go back to practicing the other way. Fiona. Did you feel pretty present at that point? Pretty calm? It's quite normal as concentration gets stronger and the person gets calmer that the breath gets more and more subtle. And sometimes you hardly feel any movement or any change of sensation at all. And sometimes actually the breath disappears entirely. The person's not aware of breathing at all. And so if you have some idea that the breath is always supposed to be deep and relaxed, that interferes with the natural process of the breath getting subtler and subtler. And as the process goes on, it might just be a very simple little kind of feeling of pressure or tightness or something you might feel in one particular spot that still shows you that you're breathing. Very little going on. And very difficult to discern. Maybe it takes a little bit extra effort to hang in there with it. And then at some point it might disappear entirely and you cannot discern that you're breathing at all. And you know you've been alive for the last 10 minutes, so you know somehow it's working. But you know the metabolism gets really, really slow sometimes when you're concentrated, and you don't need as much oxygen. And so that's part of the reason why the breath can get so subtle, is there's much less need for oxygen as you get quieter and quieter, and with the brain. And so it's a function of concentration. Take it as a good sign.
Thailand, Ajahn Buddhadasa's monastery, and I didn't know anything, but we spent it was this progression. He did the long breath until he had that down, and then the short breath. And I didn't exactly know what that having it down meant, but can you talk about playing around with that? You know, or do you, you know, believe in that method? Or I mean, even though I did it for 10 days, I'm not exactly sure what the method was. But just, you know, I mean, you had to purposely breathe a long breath or a short breath to.
In Buddhadasa's monastery, they teach a very classic Buddhist meditation practice on the breath and breathing. It goes back to the Buddha, called Anapanasati, which is, literally means breathing, mindfully breathing in and out. And, but there are 16 stages to this practice. And the first two stages, well, first stage has to do with being mindfully breathing a short breath, I think. Second stage is mindfully breathing in and out a long breath. And then it goes on from there. And it's basically using the breath as the anchor or the foundation of the practice, and then developing. And some of it involves changing and developing yourself as you go along until the concentration builds up quite strongly. And it leads all the way to enlightenment, the last 16th stage. And it's a beautiful way of practicing. It's a wonderful way. It's certainly effective. This thing about breathing in long and in short, I mean, I don't know if the Buddha had in mind you're supposed to intentionally breathe in long for a while until you have that down, and intentionally breathe in short for a while until you have that down. I take it to be mostly that you're aware of breaths with the long as being long. As it gets more subtle, you're aware of it, that it's subtle or shorter. And that's just the beginning, once you get the hang of it. And then you move on to being calming the body. The next stage is using the breath in a sense to calm the body. And then to calm the mind, and then gladden, kind of bring joy and delight, happiness to the body, the system as you breathe. And there's a whole 16 stages. And it's very nice. You know, if you have a whole routine of things to do, it's sometimes a lot easier to get concentrated because you have, you know what to do, the technique. I don't know what more to say. Didn't get what?
I didn't get what they were doing. I mean, it seemed like you were supposed to master the long breath and then go on to the short breath. And so you had to manipulate, you know, your breath big time, I mean, in my impression, to keep having all these long breaths. And then, okay, I understand that.
Maybe I don't actually know the specific way they teach there, but I know that the basic practice they're using, and there's different ways of interpreting that practice. And so it depends how you interpret it, how you understand how to do that practice. But I think you're very quickly supposed to go beyond that. But it is a kind of manipulation. It's like, you know, okay, now I'm going to use the breath to calm the body. I'm going to use the breath to relax the mind, to rest the mind. So, you know, so this kind of calming effect of the breath is really championed, used a lot in order to get more concentrated. And the gladdening effect, as you get concentrated with the breath, there's a kind of joyful effect and produce joy. And so you intentionally kind of try to evoke that joy that can come with being concentrated. And then you move on to, at some point, becoming aware of impermanence. And as you go into impermanence, you kind of join the program the way we do it. But that you kind of led yourself there in different ways. It's much more systematic. For some people, it works much better to have a systematic approach. For some people, it's better to have more of an unsystematic approach. It depends on people. The American Vipassana movement, which has much more focuses in a sense on choiceless awareness and kind of not being, there kind of a tendency not to de-emphasize the technique aspect of practice in the American Vipassana movement. And partly it's because it's kind of an ultimate practice to do that. It's very profound to do that. But also because then the practice is more helpful in one's integrated life and the wider aspects of one's life. One follows the 16 stages of Anapanasati. You can be a great meditator in the cushion doing those, but it doesn't necessarily help you with how to be mindful of your emotions or, you know, at work or various kinds of situations. And the more choiceless awareness that's taught is much more creates kind of much broader foundation of knowing how to practice in a wide area of life. There's probably thousands of different ways of doing breath meditation. You know, you can probably be quite busy doing all the different techniques. And even just in Buddhism, there's different ways of doing it. So the idea is to find, you know, find what's helpful for you and not helpful for you, and find your way from there. Other thoughts or concerns? Is that helpful this morning for you? Did you find that and interesting and to go follow along? Yes?
What do you do with your eyes? I mean, I know they're closed, but do you look straight ahead? Do you look down?
I suspect that most people don't give it any thought. They just close their eyes and they don't think about it again. They're worried about it. Though some people would like to know, like you're asking, and some people are quite concerned about it. They feel kind of uncomfortable with their eyes. They're wondering what to do with them. And generally, try to do that which makes them feel rest, like they're resting. It makes them ease. For some people, it means kind of having them... Some people find it's very restful and helps kind of keep the mind more quiet to have their eyes pointing down, as if you're looking down, and that makes things more restful. For some people, makes a strain to do that. Another thing is some people will imagine they're looking into their body, and kind of imagine they're looking backwards and into their body. It helps their eyes relax more and their focus be more concentrated. Some people find that's a strain to do that. But whatever makes you kind of at ease with your eyes and hopefully helps you to forget that you have eyes. Okay. As I think many of you know, the breathing is tied to various aspects of our psychic life. The breath is both can be put down. You can breathe both consciously and unconsciously. The breathing is very much in relationship with our emotions, our feelings. As our emotions and feelings and reactions to the world change, so does our breathing. And the breath is also often a good indication of what's going on in our life. If you find yourself in a difficult situation and you have a habit of checking in with your breathing, it might be the first indication that you're maybe tense, is to notice the breath is being held some way. There's a tendency when we're tense, angry or afraid or reactive in many situations, for the center of gravity of the breathing to move up. So to tighten the stomach perhaps, tightening the stomach and breathing more from the chest. And if we're relaxed, the tendency is for the breath to drop down, center of gravity of the breathing drop down, be down here, more of a relaxed belly. And there's a big... Oh, but what's interesting is also our attitude towards life. Most of us have some fundamental attitude towards life that we carry with us. And usually it's invisible to ourselves. And we just think this is the way things are. But there are some people who feel that life is basically an oppressive place and that they always be kind of protecting themselves from being oppressed by whatever. Some people who feel that life is... always threatening, a little bit different than being oppressed by stuff, but always an insecure place to be, and they're always kind of hyper alert because they feel like it's an unsafe place to be. And there's all these kind of various attitudes we have. Or life is a place where you have to kind of be aggressive and go out and get what you want, and if you don't kind of go out there and kind of push for what you want, then you know, no good's going to come to you. And so there's always kind of this kind of pushing, aggressive kind of stance that some people take. And I don't know if those are the best examples of kind of underlying attitudes that people have, but there's often an underlying attitude that people have about life. And what's interesting is sometimes that attitude is exhibited in the way people breathe. And it's very hard to get a sense of that. But some people occasionally can, this becomes an important aid to their unfolding, is to notice what attitude is embedded in the way that they breathe. And what I mean by this, I know this sounds a little bit strange, but some people, for example, are afraid of losing control. It's a big issue for them. And so they're constantly kind of trying to keep things under control. And loss of control is very frightening for them. And sometimes that's seen in how they relate to the exhalation. Because the exhalation is a kind of a letting go. And some people are not really comfortable with letting the exhalation go all the way because there's a vulnerability there of letting go that they'd rather not have to face, to be kind of let go, let down their guard in a sense. And so some people won't allow themselves to breathe all the way out, or they'll check out at the end of the exhalation, so they don't have to be present for there. They'll go into their thoughts because that's not a good place. You know, that's safer than being there for that vulnerability. And it's, if you really stay there and stay present for the exhalation, the person might discover this feeling of fear or vulnerability that comes up there and might have a way of healing that underlying attitude. Some people really like to hold on to things, don't want to let go of things. Once they have it, they feel secure and they don't want to let go. And some people, they find about breathing in, but there's a reluctance to breathe out. Some people feel oppressed by life. They don't want to take on any more things in life. They don't want more things to come their way. And there's a very subtle attitude sometimes that happens at the beginning of the inhalation. They'd rather not breathe in. They'd rather just kind of like just be there and that's pause. And they're reluctant to breathe in. Maybe they gasp suddenly, or they rush through it, or they wait as long as they can until they have to or something. Some people love the space between the out-breath and the in-breath, and because nothing happens there, so little happens there. Kind of often thoughts quiet down in that space, reactions, emotions quiet down, our relationship to the world quiets down. It's like a space, a gap. And some people like to escape to there. It's like that's where, you know, it's, you know, safe to be, and I don't have to deal with life anymore. And they kind of like to hang out there. They kind of take refuge there in a way that sometimes is not helpful. Some people are frightened to death of that place because of, you know, other reasons. So probably, you know, maybe only a small percentage of you, if you explore these things, will discover something like this. Not everyone has some attitude embedded in the way they breathe. But I've been really surprised as a meditation teacher to come across a lot of people as we begin exploring the breathing together. A lot of people have these attitudes somehow embedded in their, the way that they breathe. So what I'd like to do now is an exercise, guided exercise, which I've done many times before. And involves, again, I'm directing your attention to different parts of the breathing, but not to different parts of your body so much as to different points in the cycle of breath, the beginning of the inhalation, the middle part of the inhalation, the end of the exhalation. The beginning of the exhalation, beginning, middle, and end of the inhalation, the beginning, middle, end of the exhalation, the transition between the inhalation and exhalation. And so I'll direct you, and your job is just to become aware of what sensations, what feelings, what goes on for you at that point in the cycle. How do you experience the breath at these different points in the cycle? If your breath goes very quick, which it is for some people, it might be very hard to discern a lot of subtlety here. But if the breath is quiet and long, maybe you can see some of the subtlety involved here. And part of the reason for doing this is just become aware there's a lot of different sensations that come into play as you're breathing. And start becoming aware of the range of sensations involved just in an in-breath. It can make it more interesting, can make it more compelling, and can get you much more involved with the investigation, with the involvement, with the breathing. If you think the breath is just like, you know, just a little expansion, a little movement, and that's all, then you're going to miss, you know, a great majority of what's really happening in the breath. And in one inhalation, there are dozens and dozens of sensations that come into play and different ways of experiencing it. And you can actually be aware of a dozen different sensations just in the inhalation. It's fascinating to watch the arising and passing of it. The mind has to be somewhat concentrated, but as the practice deepens, to be aware of the range of sensations coming into play is one of the ways to deepen in Vipassana practice. But as we do this exercise, you might also see if there's any kind of attitude that seems to come to play at these different points in the cycle of breathing. And don't expect to find something. Don't guess if there's anything there. But there, you might kind of almost directly kind of sense or feel there might be an attitude there. Maybe the exhalation, the end of the exhalation, is maybe you feel more vulnerable there or some way or not. And maybe it's helpful to keep that in mind as we do this. So take a comfortable, alert posture. Just Gently close your eyes and take a few long, slow, deep inhalations. And as you exhale, long, slow, deep exhalation, relax your body. Take maybe a couple of more kind of long, slow, deep breaths. And as you exhale, relax your mind, your brain, all the thinking. Let it all disappear into the stillness at the end of the exhalation. And then let your breathing return to normal. And then spend a few rounds of breathing now, just hanging out with your breath. Noticing how the inhalation is different than the exhalation. How are they different for you? And then now, for the next while, give particular attention to the beginning of the inhalation. What is the first sensation that it heralds or marks the beginning of the inhalation? See if you can be kind of precise in noticing what the sensation is. Is it first a movement, or is it pressure, or tightening, or vibration, warmth, coolness? And then move your attention to the end of the inhalation. What's the last sensation or two that characterizes the end of the inhalation? And then somewhere in between the beginning and the end, can you be aware of any different sensations that come into play then? And then for the next few rounds of breathing, pay particular attention to what it feels like to have the switch or transition from breathing in to breathing out. And then be aware of the beginning of the exhalation. What sensation or sensations characterize the beginning of breathing out? And then what's the sensations that characterize the end of the exhalation? Or near the end? And then the middle part of the exhalation, what sensations can you discern there? And then become aware of what the transition feels like between the end of the exhalation and the beginning of the inhalation. And then very gently, see if you can connect all those different points of the breathing. Beginning, middle, and end of the inhalation. Beginning, middle, end of the exhalation. And the points in between. So there's a continuous connection with the breathing. The end of the exhalation is a time when people often wander away in thought. Be particularly careful to hang in there to get through that part of the breathing. Just let it be a letting go of thought rather than a picking up of thought. Letting go into the stillness of the end of the exhalation. You can imagine the sensations of breathing to be like waves on the ocean, and your awareness is like a cork or a ball floating on the waves, resting in the waves, letting the mind rest itself with each breath, especially with the exhalation. Not to put yourself to sleep, but rather to have the mind become still, quiet and still as the gap between the exhalation and the inhalation. Let's take another 35 minutes for a walking meditation, and so we'll start again at 3:05, and y'all can be at 3 o'clock, and And again, I'll be in that little room back there. It's kind of an informal basis, just kind of whatever way people want to come and hang out, and we can talk a little bit briefly if you have any questions. Especially the people who are new, if you want to, new to all this today, a couple of you, if you want to come first, if you have questions about any of this, particularly eager to answer your questions. So, thank you. I wanted to say a couple of words about attitude. I don't know, I have no idea from last instructions whether you discovered some attitude embedded in your breathing. There's a whole other kind of attitude that can come into play around the breath and meditation. Is we can have an attitude about the meditative breath, or an attitude idea about what we're trying to do with the breath when we're meditating, that might serve us sometimes during the meditation. But then at other times it gets in the way, but we don't know that it's getting in the way. We don't realize we're doing it. What I mean, for example, and teachers like me sometimes are at fault for doing this. We use language like resting in your breath. And so some people have this attitude that they're supposed to lean into the breath and rest in it, or they're going with the breath and trying to be comforted by the breath. They're trying to find comfort in the breath and hang in there and be comforted by, soothed by the breath. And if you're very anxious and agitated, they can be helpful to be soothed by the breath. And if you're very, you know, agitated, it's very nice to kind of be resting in the breath and helps getting concentrated. But if it's done too much, it pushes a person in the direction of becoming sleepy, the energy becoming kind of too complacent. And it's also an attitude that's not necessary, and as the practice goes deeper. And so you want to be, at some point you want to notice if you have some extra attitude towards the breath, like you're being soothed by it, and just kind of let go of that and just be with the breath in a very matter-of-fact way. It's just feeling it, being concentrated on it, not trying to do anything extra except for being with the breath in and of itself. Some people have the attitude that the breath is boring. When they sit down, they, you know, that's the idea. When they sit down, the kind of preconceived idea, the breath is inherently boring. And so, like, what's the big deal here? I'll just do it as a duty, you know, it's my obligation to be with the breath. And there's kind of attitudes we have in relationship to meditation, the meditative breath, that are sometimes helpful to study and notice when they happen, so they don't get the upper hand. The other thing is that as people stay with the breath is also a concentration subject. Some people, well, their concentration gets stronger, their calmness gets stronger, and they start falling asleep. It's helpful to find a way of using the breath also as a way of bringing energy and waking up the mind, rather than just having the breath be kind of a place to rest and get more and more tired. And there's various ways in which people teach about how to use the breath as a help aid to waking up. The one that I know the most for myself, and the one I'll just share with you, is sometimes it can help to emphasize in some way the inhalation, or the lifting or energizing aspect of the inhalation, what I do is as I'm breathing in, there's a kind of a lifting of the torso with the breathing in, and then as I exhale, I don't let go of the lift in the as so much in the chest and the shoulders, a little bit, but not so much. But rather, I let the letting go happen down my back. So there's kind of a circular motion, kind of lifting of energy, lifting of my front rib cage, and then relaxing down the back rib cage, keeping a little bit of lift there. And that, for me, tends to bring more energy into the system. It's kind of uplifting energy when I sit. And it doesn't always work, for sure. Some people probably have seen me falling asleep in front of you and have noticed. But that's one way, kind of playing with the breath, using the breath in different ways, both for energizing ways and for calming ways, can help to bring balance. But if you make it the policy, kind of unconsciously always having this attitude towards the breathing, then sooner or later it gets in the way of the practice itself. Does that make sense? What I'd like to suggest for this next sitting is that you use it primarily as a concentration period. The breath is really wonderful both for purposes of concentration and for mindfulness. And last sitting, we were kind of looking at the sensations of the breath. It's more of a mindfulness exercise. This time, I'd like to suggest you do it as a concentration exercise. And that is to really make an effort now to use whatever you've built on for the early part of the day to really stay focused on every single breath that you can without getting tense or upset about it. Just really trying to stay concentrated, focused on the breath. Each inhalation, each exhalation. The mind might fall away, probably, but just come back and try to really hang in there. Sustain the attention over time. See how long you can stay there over a series of breaths, staying with the breath. It can help if you count the breath. You don't have to count, but you can count each exhalation, which is a classic way, up to 10. Each breath gets a count. Count to 10, then start over again. If you lose count, start over again at 1. And the counting sometimes can keep you on track. You can use your experience as a feedback loop. So if there's a way in which the breath, you can make it more pleasant, adjust it so it's more pleasant, more comfortable to keep you interested in staying with the concentration, then it's a lot easier to stay with it. If the mind is getting more pleasant, more comfortable, more restful as you get concentrated, you can use that as a kind of a cheerleader, kind of encouraging you to keep going with the concentration. There are other kind of mental or physical feelings of delight sometimes, or ease, that can arise as you're getting concentrated. And you can use those as an encouragement to stay on track, to stay with what you're doing already and keep doing more of it. Can you adjust the breath to make it comfortable? Can you be with the full breath? Some people try to get concentrated in the breath and they're there with a moment or two of part of the inhalation or part of the exhalation. But if you're not there with the whole inhalation, the whole exhalation, then the mind is idle. An idle mind will get in trouble. Idle mind will go start thinking about something. So the part of concentration is to have a continuity of attention with the whole inhalation, the whole exhalation. And then if there's a gap before the next inhalation, you want to be sure you stay alert during that gap so the mind again doesn't drift off into thought. Does that make sense, what I'm saying? One of the amazing things many of us do when we do concentration practice is that we get discouraged. And because, you know, it's not going as well as it's supposed to be going. You're supposed to be getting concentrated and your mind keeps drifting away. So, can I tell you, just don't get discouraged? Is that helpful? For this next half an hour? Just kind of, you know, matter of fact, you know, do your best. And it actually matters less how well you do it as it does that you're trying to do it. It's kind of like building a muscle. You don't have to succeed so much as you keep trying to strengthen that muscle of concentration. And that building that muscle is what will help you in the long term. Getting calm here is, you know, help you for a while. But so the important thing is to try. And do it in a fun way, a playful way, relaxed way, enjoyable way. But you're really going to stay there with the breath for this next period. So you can just start in whatever way you want to start. And close your eyes and sit up straight and find a way to enter the world of your breathing as if your breathing is the most important thing in the world. Nothing is more important than breathing. No thought, no idea, no sensation, no feeling. Just breathing. Let's take 15 minutes for some little walking time, a break, bathroom break, and come back again, start again at 3 o'clock, at 4 o'clock. How's that? that think it might be better? Because it brings your knees down, which might be easier. And it might actually make it better for your back. Okay. So it's about 4 o'clock, and we go until 4:30 today. And we can do one of three things. I don't think we could do all three. We could, I guess, but... and that is, I could give a talk, which is pretty traditional in these one-day sittings, is to end the day with the talk. Or we could do another sitting, having a little thing to want to say about sitting and the breath that maybe is interesting. Or we could just spend the rest of the time having a discussion. Maybe you have questions or concerns or topics you want to bring up and on the day today and feedback about the day or something. Or questions about practice in general. And so do you have a preference of what you'd like? And I have my preference is that we sit again, because I think sitting is just great. And I think it's great for you. Much better than any words I have to say. But what would you like? It's a little bit hard to ask a whole group because of different opinions, but I was kind of unsure how to continue here today. What would you like?
I like the talk. It's like dessert. It's a reward.
You don't know what I have to say.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, much against what you said earlier, your preference, I would agree. I think
You would like to talk to? Yes, the vocal people want to talk. how many people would like to have a talk at this point? And how many would you prefer to sit another sitting? Well. Well, you're supposed to be always, you know, practicing. It's actually in it's actually a very wonderful way to practice, is to practice during a talk. You see, in a lot on retreats, especially, people use a talk as a time off, you know, and it's like vacation. They kind of like they sprawl out and they find their chairs. It's like, you know, entertain me, please. And actually, one of the best ways of doing a Dharma talk during a retreat is to actually keep staying in your place and keep sitting, and even with your eyes closed, and kind of take in the talk, but remain mindful, stay in the flow of mindfulness, and don't give up your mindfulness because you're hearing a talk. And okay, I'll. One of the things I wanted to say, but part of the closing meditation too, if we had one more, but I'll say it now as part of the talk, is that there's an interesting inverse relationship between stillness and movement or agitation. And what I have in mind here is that the more agitated the mind is, the more likely it is the mind is going to fixate on things and focus on concepts of things as opposed to how they actually are. The mind is agitated, is concerned about ideas, thoughts, memories, fantasies about the future. It's caught up in things. And often when the mind is agitated, one of the ways it often doesn't see the world as it actually is. It sees it through the filter of those concepts and ideas. And traditionally it's said that there's a number of kind of illusionary ways in which illusions by which we see the world with an agitated mind. And one of them is we see things as being permanent. We see permanence. So, for example, we're completely agitated and anxious and upset, and we think, I'm always going to be this way. You know, I'm always going to be depressed. I'm always going to be angry. I'm always going to be this way. And maybe, literally, if someone tested you on this, you'd know better. But in the moment, we act as if it's always going to be that way. It's kind of like, this is like, oh my God, this is how I am, and this is so embarrassing. But there's an illusion of permanence when the mind is agitated. And you can see that with physical pain, for example. When the mind is agitated around pain, the pain seems quite solid. When the mind is quite still and concentrated, that solidity of the pain disappears into the pain is actually a field of movement. And so the inverse relationship, the paradox, is that as the mind becomes stiller and quieter, then the world of impermanence becomes clearer and clearer. And in fact, the mind becomes really, really still. The body, the bodily experience, the experience of the world, becomes this amazing canopy of arising and passing, of impermanence, of change and constant flux. So there's this kind of like this relationship that where the more agitated the mind is, the less it can see impermanence, the more it tends to see permanence. And the more still the mind, so the more impermanent the mind is in a sense, the more it projects permanence in the world. And the more still the mind is, the more it can see impermanence, flow and change in the world. Just in the body, for example, the body becomes this field of constant movement and change. That makes sense, this inverse thing? And so as the mind gets stiller in meditation, more concentrated, it gets stiller and stiller, stiller, and it enters into what some people call an immobile state. And the extreme form of it is, it's not the kind of frozen state, but extreme form of it is the immovable state is a synonym for nirvana, for the state of enlightenment. The mind enters into this immovable state. When the mind is very equanimous, the mind feels like it doesn't move. It doesn't move for or against anything. Whatever arises, it doesn't react to it for or against it. It's just very still and very quiet. In relationship to the breath, there's a simile of the lame person that the ancient tradition gives. And that is that, I don't know quite why it's a lame person, but it's like this lame person who's sitting at the on a stool, next to a swing, where some child is swinging on the swing. And the person, every time this child comes by, gives the person, push, so it keeps the child swinging on the swing. And the person doesn't move from his or her stool, but is able to watch the coming and going of that swing. The swing comes towards him, goes away, comes back, goes away, and sees the whole, the beginning, middle, and end of that swing. But the person doesn't move. In the same way, the mind, or the inner the sense of observation or stillness of the mind, can watch the movement of the breath, for example. And there's a lot of movement in the breath that can be, the stiller the mind is, the greater the movement and the change you can see in the breathing. And but the point of observation doesn't change. The point of being the observer is quite still, very, very still, very spacious. Just arising and passing. So everything else is arising and passing in this field of stillness, of spaciousness. And that can sometimes feel like a still point, and sometimes can feel like the still space within which everything occurs. And being sensitive to that part of your experience which becomes stiller and stiller, versus that part of the experience which becomes more and more moving and flowing, is a helpful aspect of meditation, I believe. The mind becomes more and more still, or the sense of observation, the observer, in a sense, becomes stiller and stiller, and the world becomes more and more a world of flux and change. And as you go, you follow this to the far end of immobility, it isn't that you become again frozen or fixated, but this tremendous, spacious, peaceful quality of the mind where it just seems completely doesn't move toward anything. That which is immovable, that which doesn't move. In the Zen tradition, they have this expression. It's kind of like a koan. Who is it that is not busy? We're all busy, right? Isn't that what we do in Silicon Valley? We speak busy. And people are always busy, and they're busy. If you're not busy at work, you're busy doing all kinds of things and running around and and the question is, but who, you know who it is that's not busy? Even in the midst of your busyness, who is it that's not busy? Where is that still point in the midst of your being? Where is a still space of awareness that's always here, that is not busy, that's not caught up in the things of the world? And requires discovering that part of your being which is not caught up. No matter how busy you are, it's not caught up. That still point, the immovable, immobile. I don't know how it sounds in your ears to hear about the immovable or immobile place, but the tradition has a great emphasis on this immovable place, state. So how do you attain the immovable state? How do you find this great stillness, this great peace? Certainly through meditation practice and through concentration and mindfulness as we're doing today. But it's also helpful to know that there are supportive conditions that help support the possibility of discovering this kind of peace. And that these supportive conditions are something you can do about your behavior, about your change, something you do, besides just hoping for grace, hoping for it to just come just on its own. In some great part, the great experiences of meditation are like grace. They kind of come on their own. You can't will them into being. But some people say they're kind of like accidents when they happen. But you can make yourself more accident prone. And someone told me this yesterday. They said, I forget, maybe it was one of you who said it to me. Maybe you correct me, but said, chance, like good chance, I mean good happening, chance is more likely arises when you're prepared. A prepared mind is more likely to have beneficial things, opportunistic things arise that you pay attention, that you can take advantage of. So, the Buddha said, I'll paraphrase it because it's a little bit archaic English the way it's been translated. If you have five things, then the practice of mindfulness of breathing will quickly take you to the immovable. So you'll quickly attain the immovable by practicing mindfulness of breathing if you have these five supportive conditions. First, the practitioner undertakes little, has few duties, is easily supported, well contented with the necessities of life. Undertakes little, has few duties. So this is basically if you live a simple life. So many of us don't want to live a simple life. We would rather do everything possible under the sun and meditate and stay calm while we're doing it. But here, this is if you want to attain the immovable state. If you want to attain the peace that's possible through meditation practice, the great realization that's possible, if that's what you want, then it's better if you live a simple life. And if you live a life that's full of duties, a lot of responsibilities that keep your mind concerned, agitated, and preoccupied, it's very hard to do the kind of deep work that will take you to that great immovable state. So you live a simple life, you have few responsibilities, you are easily supported, which means that your lifestyle is easily supported. You don't live an extravagant lifestyle. It takes a lot to support it, so you're always concerned and anxious about how to support it and take care of it. But you live an easy lifestyle, which is kind of an example of Buddhist monastics who have very little to support them. And hopefully they're quite happy with having very little. The idea of monastics is they have just enough so that their body can be comfortable, but not so much that the body becomes lethargic, you know, that kind of comfort. But not so little that the body becomes, you know, is agitated because you have so little. So you have, you know, have one or two sets of clothes. That's enough to keep the body comfortable, isn't it? You have, adequate food to eat. But you don't eat a lot, you know, just adequate. So for monastics, that means you take care of all your eating before noontime. Because you can take care of your body just fine, just most people, but eating before noon, all your eating happens before then. And then in the afternoon, you don't have to think about cooking anymore or getting food. You just kind of practice for the rest of the day. Simplify your life that way. And you have adequate medicine. Monastics are allowed to have medicine. And they're allowed to have shelter. It doesn't have to be fancy digs. Something that keeps the rain off and keeps them warm. Something simple. So easily supported. Can you be easily supported? And it's not a moral judgment on being not easily supported. But if you want to be able to attain this deep peace that's really possible for you, it's helpful if you live a life where you're easily supported. Then the next thing is well contented with the necessities of life. So if you get the basics of taken care of, you're contented with that. You having black and white television? Is it necessary to have a television nowadays? Back in the Buddha's time it wasn't, but maybe it is for some of you. But you're content with a black and white television. Who needs a color television after all? Connected to a DVD player and all this other stuff. You need to have those things, right? It's really important. Contented with just the basic necessities of life. So you interpret that for yourself, what that means. But the Buddha said this is helpful. The next supporting condition is a person takes little food, is not addicted to filling his or her stomach. And maybe some of you have seen the effect of eating a big meal on a day of meditation, coming back from lunch, and you're sleepy. It's not very helpful for a wakeful state of mind if you eat a lot of food. It kind of tends to put a person to sleep and makes the person dull. And it isn't that you're supposed to starve yourself, but you're not supposed to overdo it with the eating so that it has a deleterious effect on your system. And so being a little bit modest in how you eat is considered to be helpful. And then somewhat related to this, the person is not torpid and is devoted to wakefulness. So the person is not dull of mind, is not devoted to kind of just being a couch potato and just kind of shutting down or being resistant in their mind to paying attention, but rather is devoted to wakefulness. And I love this expression. I don't know what the Pali is, but I like the English, devoted to wakefulness, because it comes up periodically in our tradition. People ask, where's the devotion in our tradition? Because, we don't do a lot of chanting or a lot of bowing, and we don't do a lot of, people who go into the Hindu tradition of the bhakti yoga really do a lot of ecstatic chanting, towards the divine. And just really get really high, all this ecstatic chanting towards the divine. And, where's the devotion for us? Don't you have any? We're devoted to wakefulness. Isn't that great? That's the great devotion. I think it was James at the retreat. Was it James who told the story? Similar kind of thing. He said, or someone said, that Jack Kornfield was asked the same question. Where's the devotion in this practice? And he asked, he thought for a while, and Jack said, this is the ultimate devotional practice. Because in this practice, it's like saying to God, do with me what you will. Which is like the greatest devotion, right? I surrender to you. It's up to you. So Buddhism doesn't have a God that way. But it's kind of like that. You sit down, you're going to be mindful and present for how things are, and you're just going to let what reality go through you as it wants to show itself. Whatever the feelings, the thoughts, the reactions, whatever happens, you're there. You're so devoted to the Dharma that you just surrender to what your present moment experience is. And you cultivate mindfulness in the midst of that. Does that sound like devotion? To some people, maybe. Other people don't want that. But anyway, here, the question is, you're devoted to wakefulness. Devoted to being awake to your experience. Awake, kind of attentive, alert, in a sense. Devoted to wakefulness. So this is a real priority in a person's life. Now, it doesn't have to be that. But for the purposes of attaining the immovable state, nirvana, or this great peace that's possible, it really helps if you're devoted to wakefulness, to be attentive to what's going on for you, and tracking what's going on. The fourth supporting condition, it says here, and remember this is Buddha was talking 2,500 years ago, it says, a person is well-versed and remembers what he or she has learned. And the things that the person has learned, the person learns well, remembers, bears in mind, recites verbally, and considers carefully, and thoroughly penetrates with vision. They didn't have books back then. They didn't have Dharma books. They didn't have Dharma tapes. And so people had to rely on their memory. Someone gave a teaching, and they would memorize it. Many of you know in the ancient world, it seemed that people had a better ability to memorize than we do nowadays. And so people would memorize the teachings they had, and they would keep it in mind, they keep it in memory, and they'd recite it periodically, keep it there, and they would reflect on it and think about it. This is to be engaged in the Dharma, in the teachings. Not just simply rely on mindfulness practice, but also to study a little bit. It doesn't have to be a lot of study. For it was a period of time in my practice where I would I would read one page of Dharma book, and I'd feel blown away. It's like, this is enough to keep me busy for the rest of my life. This is a lot here. And I would read one page a day and really take it in and live with that for the day and reflect on it and think about it and engage in it. And it became really rich, that one page. And sometimes reading it that way makes it a lot richer. And sometimes I'd reread the page in the course of a day. Then reading, you know, as much as I could in one day and fill myself with as many pages as I could. Sometimes I love reading the Dharma. I just read and read and read and read. And then I wouldn't remember much. You know, it doesn't really enter the psyche in a very deep way. And you want to let it enter the psyche in a deep way. Kind of really absorb it, really take it in, really reflect on it, make it your own. Challenge it, criticize it, engage with it. And sometimes reading just a little bit, one page, can be the equivalent of this instruction here, of being well-versed, learning well. And then the fifth supporting condition is the person reviews with his mind as to how far he or she is liberated. Reviews with their mind how far they're liberated. Now this is interesting because this is a caricature, but as a caricature, I think myself and other Vipassana teachers in the West give the message that the kind of the goal of the practice is to let yourself be as you are, but discover a sense of broad acceptance and equanimity about how things are. So if you're totally neurotic, you're supposed to just learn how to be completely mindful of being neurotic and be accepting of it. It's okay. You have fear, you have anger. You're supposed to let the anger arise in your practice and not be for or against it, just arise in the practice, be mindful of it. I mean, it's very powerful to do that. But the impression you get is that you're not supposed to be transformed in any way. You're just supposed to continue being neurotic, angry, or afraid in whatever way you are. And you now have the ability to be mindful of it, and you're not caught by it, and maybe not, you make wise decisions now because you're not caught by it. But you're still, you know, anger and neurosis and anxiety all are there. You're just more free in the midst of it being there. You're more accepting of it. The Buddha, I don't think he would have shook his head if he thought that was the point of practice. He would have thought he would have been maybe perplexed at this kind of teaching if that was the only thing going on in the practice. The Buddha was interested in transformation. And what that was, it's more than just a radical acceptance of how you are. It really involves uprooting the latent tendencies, the dispositions, those inherent kind of tendencies we have towards being neurotic, towards being afraid, towards being filled with lust or greed, ambition, those tendencies towards being filled with aversion or hate. So you can, it's easy enough, relatively easy enough, to go to a situation where your trigger to being angry or lustful is not going to arise. And many people have gone off to Asia to really peaceful forest monasteries, they're going to Spirit Rock, you know. Spirit Rock is a pretty nice place, very peaceful and quiet, and you go on retreat for a few days or a few months or whatever, and it's really nice, you know, a very peaceful place there, and you get calmed down after a while, and it's very nice, and you think, well, you know, I'll never get angry with anyone ever again, and you do loving kindness for a whole month, you know, and I'll never get, you know, or I'll never get depressed again, I'll never get, you know, irritated, I'll never get filled with desire, I know better now, this is, you know, I've arrived. And you don't realize how much it's dependent on Spirit Rock. You know, it's wonderful, you know. You're free of all these conditions. And then you go back home, you go back to the world of your job and work and all these things, and lo and behold, you feel suddenly you get filled with irritation and anger and desire and fear and all these things. And it's not you, of course, right? It's the world. So you run back to Spirit Rock. That's, you know, where you can be enlightened. So what happens is a very common scenario. People don't realize that latent tendencies, the buried tendencies, the hidden tendencies to anger, to desire, to fear, to anxiety, are still there. They're just not operating because nothing's there to trigger them. And the Buddha didn't want everybody to live at Spirit Rock. What he wanted was people to uproot the latent tendencies, to somehow transform those buttons so those buttons don't get pushed anymore. And so, the Buddha said, it's periodically useful to review how far you are in being liberated. Do you still get angry at your spouse? So one of my markers that I made progress in my retreat life, my Buddhist practice, was I stopped getting angry on retreat. My early retreats, you know, I'd get so angry, mostly at myself, and so discouraged. And but at some point I noticed I could do a 7-day, a 10-day retreat, a longer retreat, and I didn't get angry anymore. I thought that was really good. I thought, wow, that's amazing. I mean, it wasn't like I was doing great concentration and great mystical states or anything, you know, and, you know, I wasn't a great star yogi in any kind of way, but I would go to retreat and I wouldn't get angry. Wow. I mean, that's like a psychic power, right? Amazing thing. And so, to that degree, I've been liberated from, you know, anger on retreats. I mean, it wasn't, you know, I mean, maybe where I came from. I remember once sitting on retreat, this was in Japan, in the Zendo, and I wasn't angry with myself, I was angry with the person next to me. And it was the closest I've ever gotten in my adult life to punching someone out, is in the meditation hall in the Zen temple, meditating. Amazing. So this latent tendencies can operate even in unusual, you know, in those kind of pristine environments. I'm glad I didn't, because being a foreigner in an all-Japanese temple, I probably wouldn't have been, the punch probably wouldn't have been received very well by the other monks. But so at some point I noticed that I could get through a retreat without getting angry. So a person reviews. And I think the reason for this reviewing is not to feel bad about yourself. And the Buddha wasn't trying to make you feel bad about how unliberated you are, but rather to encourage you to keep practicing, to stay working on it. Because it's easy to get complacent. Oh, I'm comfortable now, and this is, you know, get complacent there. But to keep going. And there's a great story of Ajahn Chah, who felt pretty good about his practice. He'd done a lot of years of practice, and he'd attained a certain level of peace and equanimity and joy and happiness in his practice. But he wanted to test it to see, is this really, you know, have I really arrived? Am I really now finally an arhat, you know, whatever. So he spent 3 days. I don't recommend this for most of you. But he spent 3 days trying to conjure up lust. And I don't know how he did it exactly, but he was trying. Maybe he had his Vipassana romance person. And he was trying. And after 3 days, it came, his lust. And he realized he hadn't finished his work, that latent tendency was still there. And so he threw himself back into practice. So the idea, traditionally in Buddhism at least, is that we have these latent tendencies, and we want to find some way to address those and free ourselves from them so we can be transformed by the practice, not just simply become, you know, learn how to be much more accepting and equanimous about what's actually here, but actually change what's here in some very deep kind of way. That's at least the traditional way that the Buddha taught. So reviewing how far you're liberated so you feel encouraged to keep on in the practice and not kind of rest on your laurels. Was one of the strategies the Buddha offers. So I actually read this list yesterday at a sitting yesterday, and one person said, it sounds like I'm supposed to be so busy doing all these five different things I have to be doing. But I read this as being actually, you're supposed to be doing less. I mean, undertakes little, has few duties, doesn't eat a lot, it means you don't have to cook a lot, you know, stay easy, you know, stay simpler with your food. Is not torpid, stays devoted to wakefulness. The only thing that really makes you busy, I suppose, is being well-versed and remembers what he or she has learned. But I'm interpreting that for you, just read one page a day. So that's not going to make you that busy. And then the person reviews with his or her mind how far it is liberated, how far one's mind is liberated. Well, I don't think too many of you are, you know, have to spend a lot of time reviewing how liberated you are. I don't think you're going to be busy on that. I don't think this is about being busy here. It's actually becoming less busy And as you become less busy and simplify your life, that is supportive for taking this mindfulness of breathing practice to its limit, to the far extreme of what's possible in it. You don't have to take it that far. If you simply want to have happy living in the here and now, as I read this morning, as I reported this morning, mindfulness of breathing helps you live happily here and now with how things are. But it also, mindfulness of breathing, is very conducive practice to the liberation that's possible, the uprooting of these latent tendencies towards fear, anxiety, greed, hate, and the various things that keep us caught up in our minds and hearts. So I hope that this day has been helpful for you in spending a day focusing on the breath and becoming more familiar with it, and maybe learning different ways of being with the breath, and as a way that's helpful, that maybe helps you to develop more concentration, more mindfulness, more continuity with the breath. Make the breath a refuge for you, a friend, an ally that helps you in the practice, not only in the cushion, but also in your daily life. It's really helpful to come back to your breathing in your daily life and notice what's going on with your breath. Notice what the breath is showing you about the state of your mind and your emotional state. The breath is really great. I love it. I've been doing this now for almost 30 years. I find the breath more and more interesting the more I do this. So I tell you that with a hope that in a helpful way that inclines your mind to be more interested in your breath. If Gil is more interested after 30 years of this, you think, I get more bored, right? After 30 years of watching my breath, after a while, it's like, you've got it, right? I'm actually finding it more and more interesting, more fascinating as the longer I do this. So may that incline you in a helpful way to be more interested in your own breath. So that's it. I talked. Not even time for discussion or sitting, unless you were sitting while I talked. It's 4:30. So I enjoyed the day a lot. It would be nice to get some feedback on this kind of day, because I try all these things, make all these guided meditations as a way of trying to be helpful, but I assume that some of it's helpful to some people and some of it's not so helpful, and some of you are irritated about having someone talking during meditation. People tell me that sometimes. So I used to be irritated sometimes, so I assume that's going on. So you can tell me, because I assume it's some of you are feeling that way. But it's nice to get some feedback. So if I do this again sometime another next year, day of mindfulness of breathing, I get a sense of what's useful and what's not and things like that. So we're going to end now. What I'd like to ask is that in having this our own center here, we have become the stewards of our own building. It used to be we were stewards of other people's buildings. At the end of one-day sittings at St. Mark's, we'd always have a few volunteers who stay behind and help just tidy up the place, so we return it to the owners in a tidy way. Now we're the owners of this place. And it would be nice if a few of you could volunteer to stay behind and help tidy up the place, get it ready for Sunday morning. The chairs need to be set up the way they were when we came, two rows in the back and one row along here. And maybe a couple of people can get the vacuum cleaner. And there's three vacuum cleaners. Maybe a couple of people can vacuum this floor here after we've taken all our things out. And maybe one person can vacuum the floor where the carpet where the shoes are. And perhaps someone can volunteer to mop. It's pretty quick to mop the big floor there where we did walking meditation, where maybe some of you had lunch. And sweep and mop, maybe in the kitchen. And maybe one person, one or two, a few people can go just tidy up the bathrooms a little bit, empty the trash cans and stuff. So that's a lot of little chores. I don't know if we just hope someone, I don't know, we're going to volunteer. Who would like to vacuum? Paula. Peter? Mike. And who would like to sweep that big floor? It's really fun to take the mop. It's like a Zen thing to do. And what else did I say?
Chairs.
Chairs. Who can stay just one, two, three. And who would like to tidy up the bathrooms? It's also a Zen thing to do. One, two, three. In Zen monastery, it's the most senior, you know, highest status monk who cleans the bathrooms. So you really got it good. And if there's something else some of you can think of doing, it'd be nice. And otherwise, I want to thank you all very much for helping and for being here today. And I look forward to next time.